So it's our pleasure to be here for the second day and to continue our talks and our discussions. Thank you for coming. It's a weekend and we do remember about that. So thanks for coming once again. And today we will be more focused on the city and on urban issues, but still we keep in our mind the idea of graffiti and street art. And that's my pleasure to introduce Andrea Briganti to you. And that's quite a rare chance actually to introduce someone who is a professional dreamer. And Andrea is a part of that small independent and free research group that with this name that's called On Walls and Practices Related to the Walls. So Andrea is from University of Trento, Italy, and she is an aggregate professor of social theories and space and culture. So, and recently he published a book on visibility in social theory and social research, and I hope that some things will become much more visible for us after his presentation today.
Thank you very much. It was so kind of you to invite me, and I feel a bit isolated up here, but I managed to connect to you and also, I managed to connect to our discussion because I think that we are basically going on pursuing the conversation that we started yesterday, and we actually delved into a number of issues and problems that are of concern to all of us. So actually at the beginning my idea was to present more like my some of my empirical research. But as yesterday was unfolding, a number of ideas came to my mind. So I'll try to see if I managed to keep everything together, and to share with you my some of my theoretical obsessions, and which concern visibility, as it has been said, but also territories and what we do with territories. What are these territories that we make, and how could we use this notion to actually make social research? Sometimes I even dare to say that in a way sociology should turn into a sort of territoryologist, into a study of territories. Because they are so important. So I will try to focus on some of these concepts. And concepts actually for me means intensities in a way. It means that concepts are sort of knots that we try to, and when we name them, we only have an approximation to the many problems that are involved in them, and we try to detail these problems and work with these problems. So I'm not particularly a person for solving problems, but I like to spell them out, at least to articulate them. And today I will try to connect, as my title says, the some reflections, some observation that I did with graffiti. I started an ethnography back in 2005, and I did an ethnography of a pretty, I would say, pretty conventional and pretty traditional graffiti crew in northern Italy, called Overspin. And after that, I remained in touch with the scene, with graffiti scene, and I observed how in recent years a graffiti scene had to something to do and differentiated itself at the same time from street art, and how some street artists, some former graffiti writer turned into street artists, and some street artists sharply differentiated themselves from the graffiti scene and stuff. So some of these complexities here. And the other part of my presentation would be on value. So what is this notion of value, and how do we give value to places? And visibility is pretty much in it, because I think, and I already sort of say that, in a way, much of these games are played out in public space, and or what I prefer to call public domain, because actually public space, it has some specifically, I would say, legal or juridical sort of overtone to it. So when I speak with lawyers, they usually quite confident about what they mean by public space and where are the boundaries of public space and stuff. And so I say law, it's extremely important, of course, and it has consequences on the lives of people, but I think as sociologists we need some more subtle understanding of what is at stake with this experience of being in public. And so I try to call it public domain, to stress that it is essentially a domain of visibility in the first place. Being in public means being visible to others, becoming visible to others in a way, accepting to be watched and stared at, and all these problems with managing the intervisibilities in public are, of course, extremely extremely subtle and extremely important part of our social lives, as classical sociologists such as Erving Goffman showed. Becoming visible also entails in a way that we enter a sort of, or create a sort of regime of interaction with others. So what is precisely this regime? What are the rules that the way we enforce those rules and we challenge those rules? There is an important distinction here for me in the fact that we tend to see the public domain as a shared space, but there is much confusion about the limit and the boundaries between the public and the common. So commonality and publicity are two notions I think we should try to articulate and to see as in a way extremely intertwined and perhaps even referring to the same phenomenon on the ground, but from slightly different perspective and sometimes from dramatically different perspectives. And so, because in a way public space and public domain is a domain of circulations, and we've seen that already in yesterday very well, even from a very governmental point of view, and here we could refer to the classical studies by Michel Foucault, to govern a space is to understand the circulations that are in it. Whereas disciplinary spaces were enclosed institutions for training bodies and attitudes, and for engendering the right disposition of action in individual beings, the open domain of the city is something that can be governed, but only within certain margins. When we want to govern a space, we accept that it is open to circulation and that there are only thresholds in which we can set and preview a set of possible events. So this is a definition that Foucault gives in his famous Security, Territory and Population course in the late 70s. And this also means, from my point of view, that the public domain entails something like a deterritorializing process, in a way. It entails the fact that the public man, the man in public, in a way, is a man of non-belonging. It detaches himself from localities and local belongings. And here we can refer to the famous figures of the flaneur and this type of horizon that defined in a way the idea of the public man. We can find beautiful reflection, for instance, in Richard Sennett's works on the experience of the public man. The public man is, in a sense, the man. I also like a French sociology, which is kind of marginalized in a way, but I think very important theoretician of the public experience, who was, and is that now, who was Isaac Joseph. And Joseph wrote a beautiful essay on the what he called the dispersal of public space. And the dispersal of public space does not refer to the mourning for the end of public space that is present in a sort of critical kind of studies, but it refers to the fact that public space is structurally dispersed, is scattered around. You can't gather it in one single place. And so the man in public is someone that who does not belong in any local communities. To become public entails this movement of deterritorialization. And then the other fundamental dimension of the public domain, which makes possible that the public domain is not simply a local space, is the fact that the public entails a dimension of address, of public address, of addressing to a public. And this is the other notion of public that comes from, traces back to at least Gabriel Tarde, another very important thinker to my mind in the late 19th century, early 20th century, one of the, let's say, the founding, I would say one of the founding inspirational scholar for media sociology. So the idea that there are publics, and these publics are dispersed, and they are reached by this attempt at connecting them. So what this gives us, not much, but at least a perspective that is radically different from the classical liberal description of public space. There is no blank public space. Public space is never neutral. It's not the white canvas upon which the things are then added, but it is created by these, precisely these movements and these forth and back, these movements which are inherently, I would say, movements of appropriation and resistance. We enter public space, we occupy public space, we appropriate public space, and there are movements that reverse these dynamics and resist these appropriations. So then the other dimension I'd like to focus on is perhaps, and yesterday it has also been addressed in a way, is the idea of an urban visual ecology. So what is an ecology? At bottom it all boils down to a very simple idea. An ecology is a combination of parts that cannot be reduced to each other, and these parts are defined by their relationships. And so a visual ecology means that in a way there is a composition, there is a visual composition of the cityscape, of the urban landscape, which is made of course of juxtapositions, of layerings, of transparencies, various degrees of transparency and diaphony and a diaphony. And so this is the idea that the visual ecology is both in a way collaborative and conflictual, simultaneously. You can't have one without the other. So you have this composition of heterogeneous part that defines urban visual ecology. And of course, visibility has pretty much to do with this, because actually, what is visible, what is invisible, what are the conditions of appearance, what are the conditions that can manage a certain visibility of a certain piece of visual ecology vis-à-vis others can be accepted. Also, visibility is relevant from the point of view of value, and I would say that we have sort of entered an economy of visibilities. Visibilities are not necessarily hierarchized, but we have entered an age in which visibility are increasingly so. I just invite you to consider what is the effect of Google as a search engine, hierarchizing, indexing visibilities. So, and we've mentioned yesterday in some of our conversation, increasingly we ourselves are ranked and measured, and we have our, and we go around the world, we're struggling for getting the best university rankings and the best H indexes, etc. It is not strictly an academic practices. We also struggle for getting a lot of people out there struggle for getting a number of friends on the Facebook accounts, etc. So visibility is increasingly, it matters from this point of view. And visibility, of course, is a very ambiguous kind of social territory, because it, of course, we see this with this enabling side of visibility. We tend to focus on this, and we want visibility. We look for this visibility in terms of getting recognition. This is the dialectics of recognition already described by Hegel. On the other hand, visibility also entails control. So, and this is the story that Foucault taught us in his studies on discipline. Becoming visible, visibility is a trap, wrote Foucault in that famous Birth of the Prison book, Discipline and Punish. Becoming visible means becoming also the principle of our one's own subjection. That was Foucault in the mid-70s. By the early 80s, Foucault increasingly focused on one of these other technologies of the technologies of power, which makes this working of consensual construction of relationships, which he called the self. So we ourselves become the subject of these mechanisms. And yesterday we also considered that as we enter this economy of visibility, we face the fact that this struggle for visibility as recognition is a struggle for attention, for public attention. And this is a paradoxical thing, because as we feel the visual ecology of the city, we not only produce meaning, but we also produce noise, and visibility turns into a scarce and fleeting resource. And so we want to make brands in order to assert certain precise meanings or certain precise configurations. It's very much, of course, a Gestalt exercise. We want to focus on a shape and leave the background without shapeless, in a way. But this also, of course, creates this peculiar dynamics in which we are always on the verge of this thriving state, of this crowd state, I would say. And the urban visual ecology is often in a crowd state. So my other starting point is this, is its famous Zimmel's essay on Bridge and Door, and there's this beautiful passage where Zimmel writes, "Walls are mute." It's a beautiful entry point, because then you look at these walls here, and they are anything but mute in a way. Or these walls here, and this is Paris, and this is Madrid, and then we know these are the kind of visual scape that we are probably most familiar with, especially as street art scholars or people who make research into street cultural production. So what kind of muteness was Zimmer talking about? Brassai in the 30s used to write about, he started this collecting the bastard art of the hill-famed streets, as he called it, and he started documenting all these crowds of inscriptions in the public domain and in public space. But as concerned, so what is the relationship of this peculiar configuration, this complex configuration of visibility and visual ecology of the city and the production of value? So here I would like to refer to an old cherished author, a German author, which also means very serious one, and which you, so for some reason, for some national reason, you are much more familiar with than me, Karl Marx. Karl Marx was a rather cosmopolitan, actually, intellectual, and a German of Jewish descent and of radical political persuasion. He had to spend most of his life roaming around and observing city life, in a sense. He was also very enthusiastic about city life. I think if Marx were alive today, it would be into new media studies, I think. Yeah, because it's the attention that he paid to all kind of technological innovation that was going on at his time is it's impressive. And there is a part at the beginning of The Capital where he describes a very interesting process, and I would like to refer back to him because it's a very tricky notion, I think, and it's but yet very important. It's a notion he named Verwertung, valorization, the process through which things get value. And it's basically it draws two different diagrams, and these are, I mean, very famous, but it's interesting to go back to this. One is this, and the other is this. I tend to think about it in Italian because this is commodity, money, and this is money. And of course, they are part of the same chain, of the same ongoing and unfolding chain. But when you go from commodity to commodity, you basically end up there. You want something to make your living up to fix, so you need something that strictly concerns use value. Whereas when you go from, so this is basically purchase and this is sale, here is where basically capitalism begins. There is a process of valorization in the sense that Marx says it would be nonsense if the initial M equals the final M. There must be a difference, even if only a conceptual one, because we want to make trade in order to increase money. Even if things turn out wrong and we eventually lose money in the transaction, but what we aim at is making profit, making money. So there is this peculiar dynamic which is related, and it's very interesting that Marx himself refers to why should people face this uncertainties of circulation. He uses precisely this phrase, the uncertainties of circulation. As I said before, the public domain is one of these domains of circulatory domains. So how happens that things enter this circulatory domain? And of course, this, the real scheme is of course something like this, in the sense that there is a difference from the initial and the final value, and there is this process of valorization. And Marx says it's something like, it's sort of it looks like a magical thing, because it seems like the production of value, this valorization of capital, goes on like on its own dynamic. This hides the fact that, of course, the real origin of value is labor and what Marx called labor power. But in this dynamic, there is, of course, something that is going on, this circulatory uncertainties that characterize the creation of value. So some of my question really concerns what is it that creates this value, and what is it that, on the contrary, destroys value? Who is, in a sense, the enemy of value, and what is on the contrary the source, and what are the practices actually that create value? What are the practices that give value, and what is the dynamic of this value? Is it always like an increasing thing, or does it go through cycles? So we can imagine booms of values and then busts of values. This is very interesting, because when we enter, for instance, like the art world and the art market, we know that busts are not contemplated. We know that Van Gogh will never be, you know, will never go down, the quotation of a Van Gogh. So what does it mean? Is it sustainable? What is the source of the value that prevents Van Gogh from going down? And this is very interesting, especially for contemporary artists, who can boom very quickly, can escalate very quickly. What happens when they are on the top? What happens? Is it possible to, isn't the very fact of going up so quickly in the end preventing this magical trick of circulation and so stacks everything. And so, and what is the enemy of value? When you apply this to the cityscape, we can see that in a way the ill-famed streets were the enemies of value. These were places that were, it is very interesting that these studies of graffiti are only in the, at least in the, let's say, I would say in the European tradition, are strictly connected to anthropology and are only follow slightly some other studies by criminal anthropologists in the late 19th century. And I think, for instance, like people like Alexandre Lacassagne, who studied what it was called the habitué de la prison de Paris, recidivist criminals. And he studied who were these people. He had an argument with Lombroso in Italy, because Lombroso tended to focus on hereditary features and the fact that criminals are not well developed individuals. They lag behind in the human evolution and stuff. Whereas Lacassagne focused on a number of, we could say, environmental factors. This is very important. Environmental factors. One of these, very interestingly, is tattoos. And he makes an extremely detailed report about the tattoos that these criminals have. These are in bodily inscriptions, just like street graffitis are inscription of the urban skin, we could say. And of course, both these kind of inscriptions are were since the origins imagined as sort of value detracting. I recently came across a documentary which was filmed by a friend of mine in a prison in Italy, in Genova, Carcere di Marassi, where basically she interviews some of these inmates, and basically what they tell her is that it's you know, with these tattoos, when I go out, who's going to hire me? It's so visible, because you know it's typical prison tattoos, so it means that this sort of visible inscription detracts from your value, in a way, from your social value. At the same time, I think there is this idea that is, I try to sort of leak in, the fact that value concerns environments, or if you want, we might also use the word millions. It concerns atmosphere. So that value is never in a way created by a single act of a single person. Rather, it emerges when a series of such acts from independent, in a way, and persons converge or make sense in a sort of shared zone, into a sort of focal point. This is the very notion, in a sense, of milieu. It implies a sort of self-reference or self-fostering dynamics. It's a sort of system in more classical terms. And when we refer, for instance, to the study this kind of cultural production, we might also, more contemporary graffiti and street art scene, we might also refer to the word, I already said it, scene, actually. It's a scene. What does it mean to be a scene? How is value related to scenes? So yesterday there was a very interesting phrase which was street art objects that you used. So what is actually the difference between an object, and this is my other, the point I'm puzzling on in a sense, an object, let me see what, okay, then I got, yeah, okay, an object and an environment. So there are, yes, true, we tend to work on single pieces, we want to trace the story of Banksy's pieces and what the meaning of single of single artworks. But these artworks are part of an environment, of a scene, of something larger. We can, theoretically speaking, I think that the very interesting opposition is that, in a sense, the object is something that stands in front of me, and I can sort of grasp it in a way, whereas the environment is something that is around me, it surrounds me. So basically, I'm in it. I cannot visualize it as a sort of face-to-face relationship. Some objects are very curious to explore from this point of view. Like, I mean, there are of course these curious entities that can be objects or environments according to how you observe them. Take for instance a river. What is a river? Of course, when you have to plan like the trajectory of a river and you want to change the course of a river, you treat it as an object. But when you walk on a river front, you are in an environment. So what is the, how do we, you know, treat these objects? And what sort of objects are our cities, actually? Before reading the Banksy quote, of course, the New York graffiti scene was born in the late 1960s, early 70s, in a specific social context, which was the context of the crisis, of the deep crisis that the North American inner city underwent at about that time. And so we know that this this way of creating a new, let's say, urban visual scape was in, let's say, embedded in this specific process concerning certain urban areas, neighborhoods, in natural areas. In the terminology of early Chicago school, it's very interesting that if we go back to the early Chicago ethnographies, one of the most famous, of course, is the Gold Coast and the Slum by Zorbov. And basically, the Gold Coast and the Slum tells the story of this peculiar zone in the northwest Chicago. And it's a story of areas in transition, basically, of how these areas are changing and how new settled population are flowing in and transforming the meaning, the feel of the quality, let's say, of a place. And very interestingly, Zorba tells a story concerning one part of the slum. The Gold Coast is, of course, the richest part on the lake shore, and the slum is the inner part where immigrants from Sicily and Poland settle, actually. But there's a very peculiar area in between, which he calls Bohemia. And Bohemia is this peculiar place where this unadjusted or rebel young people, young artists flow in, and they try to live unconventional lives. The typical kind of idea and the representation of what later becomes. And there's a much more recent ethnography of a Chicago district which is called Neo-Bohemia. So what is the meaning of what we now call creative neighborhoods and stuff? But Bohemia was already there when Zorba observed it and described it in the late 20s. So it's kind of what is the fate of a place? If you go today to Harlem, if you visit Harlem today, there has been this so-called Harlem Renaissance. Harlem is very different from this place that you see here, and of course, what sort of value do these neighborhoods have? How these values created, transformed, by whom actually? What kind of population is entitled to give certain values, to produce certain values? What is the fate of a place, to quote a famous book by Casey, or even I would say it would be interesting to try to apply another Goffman's notion to places, which is the notion of career. How do places have a certain career? What is a career of a place? And of course, gentrification is a classical, is a much studied way of describing a career of a place, upscaling of a neighborhood, working class population being pushed, kicked out in various degrees, middle class population flowing in, and of course, dramatically changing real estate values. So it ultimately boils down to value in a very economic sense, in the sense of Verwertung, the Marxian Verwertung notion. Real estate is a very interesting thing to study, and of course it creates also a lot of anger and resentment and contestation, of course. Urban land revenue, what is the value of your specific piece of land, at least in an established capitalist, Western capitalist variant of land management. So there seems to be, but at the same time, these areas of transition are of course areas of changing values, and there must be something like a shifting point, or if you want, even let's call it a border. So there is a border. There is a border that separates anti-value, non-value from value. How is this border moving? How is this border shifting? How does this border work in a way as a sort of device for creating and sustaining the valorization process? And so I come a little bit more to street art. And the Banksy quote reads something like this. It's a very famous quote, and it's this kind of quote that when you read it the first time, you go yeah, but then you reread it and you see there are a lot of very curious things going on. So I read it: the people who run our cities don't understand graffiti because they think nothing has the right to exist unless it makes a profit, which makes their opinion worthless. They say graffiti frightens people and is symbolic of the decline in society, but graffiti is only dangerous in the mind of three types of people: politicians, advertising executives, and graffiti writers. The people who truly deface our neighborhoods are the companies that scroll the giant slogans across buildings and buses, trying to make us feel inadequate unless we buy their stuff. They expect to be able to shout their message in your face from every available surface, but you're never allowed to answer back. Well, they started this fight, and the wall is the weapon of choice to eat them back. Some people become cops because they want to make the world a better place. Some people become vandals because they want to make the world a better looking place. And also, yeah, and here is where, of course, the brandalism enterprise begins in a way. And also very interesting the fact that Banksy at that time at least self-named itself a graffiti artist, like sort of like dissociating from trying to connect himself to, you know, like this old graffiti tradition, and dissociating himself from more let's say hip. He consciously, I think, picked an out-of-date term, like to play on this distinction. So the fact is that here we see a border at work, and there is, of course, it sounds very good and it's very skillfully phrased kind of quote, and it of course shows that Banksy knows even the so-called broken windows theory of crime. And you remember broken window theory was this Reaganite ideological scaffolding, whereby the idea that graffiti were part of this urban decay and were signs of urban decay and detracting value from places and leading places to become increasingly dangerous and threatening places, and places nobody ultimately would care about, and where people would tolerate higher and higher and graver crimes. So you see, the point is that on the one hand you have decay as it is officially portrayed, and on the other hand you got the real enemy, and the real enemy are big companies, and that we want to struggle against them because they send messages to us. This is one of the dimensions of the public domain, but we can't send messages to them. This is another thing that that has been widely discussed in 20th century media studies, the fact that broadcast media don't allow you to answer. And as Jean Baudrillard put it in the late 70s, in the late 60s actually, in the La Société de Consommation, media are words without answer. So it sounds, it reads really like mostly as a Baudrillard quote here, when he says that you're never allowed to answer back. So from this point of view, it seems like graffiti is presented here in this piece of quote as you know, as a sort of strategy to break this univocal kind of communication and to reappropriate places and reassert different a different attitude and reassert a different values to the city. So what is in a way defacement to the establishment is in fact a way of struggling against the real defacement and decay, which is capitalism. And if you read it carefully, there's another very interesting part of this thing where it says graffiti is only dangerous in the mind of three people. Politicians, why? Because actually for politicians can cash on the fear of graffiti. They can run campaigns about graffiti being the sign of this of decay and this lack of discipline and this insecurity, urban unsafety, etc. Advertising executive, for the ecological reason I mentioned at the beginning, there is simply an ecological competition between graffiti and advertisement. They are all there, they are part of the same visual scape, the part of the same visual ecology, urban visual ecology, and you can only have one in the foreground. And as you bring one in the foreground, you inevitably leave the other in the background. So, you know, it's competition. It's the first part of the ethnic relation cycles in terms of the classical Chicago school. And then graffiti writers. Perhaps more tricky. Why are graffiti dangerous in the mind, it says, in the mind of graffiti writers? Practically, of course, there is this issue which concerns, you know, the fact that a lot of graffiti artists had bad experience with police, of course. And most of the people I hanged around with had been arrested, and some of them also went to trial for their graffiti writing activities. Whether they were, now I'll get more to the point, whether they are more conventional and traditional graffiti writers, or more, you know, like hip street artists coming from, let's say, a graffiti. And this is a street art group, of course, from Madrid, so you have this kind of danger. But it says also it's dangerous in the mind. So it means that in a sense, graffiti writers have the perception that what they are doing can be dangerous. What kind of danger is it? It's not simply the fact of being engaged in an illegal activity. I think this kind of danger has a lot to do with with the issue of value I'm trying to present. Of course, well, this has to do with, but here is the other point in a sense. If you think back to Brassai's kind of graffiti documentation, you can clearly see that was a mass scale, popular anonymous production, and it's still going on. The sticker culture is huge. Anything that derives from closely or loosely from the punk attitude of do it yourself has led to this massive cultural production. And interestingly, the larger the production, we've seen the stronger the stardom and the stardom system, in a way, the creation of graffiti super and street art superstar has become. So and it's very tricky. And now you can see what I was talking about the indexing of visibilities. If you go on Google and you can see the kind of visibility that an artist like Banksy has, it's extremely interesting. At the age in which a lot of young artists are engaged in this. So it means that in a way you've got a larger domain, if you wanted to refer to my idea of public domain, you get a larger public sphere, I would say, except I don't particularly like Habermasian notion of public sphere, and a higher kind of mountain, in a sense, a higher kind of peak of stardom. So that, and the two go together. It's very interesting. It's a very, and of course, yeah, the market comes after it. The marketplace follows, and you can find all sorts of merchandising. And Luke studied this very interestingly. It's also a market of coolness, in a sense, because. And it was very interesting. Well, Luke yesterday said that who are the buyers of street art posters? Middle-aged men. Aren't they? I would love to Luke to tell us more about it, because I suspect in a sense it's, you know, the kind of I want to be cool. I want to be part of this sort of. I want part of that coolness on with me on my side. I'm one of these hips. Guys who understand, who are related to that scene in a way. I have the sort of the benefits of that kind of sort of visibility and specific visibility. This merchandising is part of it. It's merchandising of objects. You can, when you want to cash it in a way, you go back to objects. But what happens when, on a larger scale, we also merchandise places? Now, I've been collected. Dozens of articles on graffiti in Italy, and the legalization, the trend towards legalizing graffiti writers in Italy, and the spaces that are increasingly given to street artists and street art events and stuff in Italy. And I have mapped out most of these events trying to differentiate the traditional graffiti convention, which were largely informal, self-organized, etc., and increasingly these street art festival events and stuff that are increasingly taken over from municipal administrations and tourist promotion thing. Another very curious one I came across. This is the wrong picture, of course, but it's just to give you the idea. This is a typical advertisement of Paris as a city of good life, you know. It's the wrong picture because I recently came upon a book which is called Paris Métropole, and it's a very official report of this, like the demography and infrastructural trends and long-term planning of the city and stuff. And then there is a chapter on culture and in the city. And you see a picture of this place from a very different perspective, from a slightly different perspective, which enables you to see, and it's unfortunate that, because that is a perfect picture, this is surrogate that I found out at the last minute, but you actually see, this is in Belleville, it's a famous, you actually see that this other place I showed you at the beginning, this, it's just behind the corner. It's actually the same place. It's actually the same place. This is Rue de Noailles. It's a small place near the Belleville metro station. So it's really been increasingly ingrained, even if not explicitly thematized. Street art is becoming part of this attractiveness of a city, of a neighborhood. And this is another, even bigger one, of course, Philadelphia. The way in which the Philadelphia city basically turned its own graffiti scene into a huge tourist attraction. Mural art, as it's called. You're invited to join Mural Arts program as we ignite change in our city, our communities, our neighbors, and ourselves through innovative and inspiring public art projects. It all sounds very good, especially when you read made possible with the generous support of the Bank of America. So you see, it's very. And what about this? Found out only recently about it. This is a small company that organizing Roca Global. It's organizing tours to the old Lisbon city center, the Bairro Alto, to visit it. And you can see we offer you the chance to experience first-hand Lisbon's urban art through a unique tour. So you got guided, just like you are guided to the Colosseum or to the Tour Eiffel, and you are guided through graffiti. It's also kind of, I would say, the target here is slightly upper middle class, I would say, because if you look at the hotels they would bring you to and the kind of pubs that you are supposed to go with them, it looks rather upper class. And so you can see even here the contradiction of trying to sell this atmosphere which was supposed to be tough and uncompromising and even gritty, as they say, in a fashionable, stylish way. So this is the l'enjeu, as the French would say, the stake. The l'enjeu, street art and graffiti and signature graffiti. Simultaneously, we see this, that people who are doing the original graffiti practice, which is bombing, which is tagging signature graffiti, are being arrested and prosecuted, and that street art is sold as something that gives value to places. Having interviewed a number of graffiti writers since the old times, it's interesting that they almost any every virtually every one of them says that they all began with bombing, with tag writing, which is the core of graffiti art, you can only claim to be a graffiti writer if you make a train. So making a train means going into the yard and being very quick in writing your name or writing a big throw up, and in matter of bunch of seconds. So it means that this is kind of horizon that was inscribed in the original graffiti scene. And street art as, of course, this also creates a difference of circulation, because tags can't be read by the general public. They are produced and consumed within, although they travel and they are highly visible, they are produced and consumed within this graffiti writer's tendentially closed and seen, whereas street art has, of course, this more ecumenic, I would say, attitude to reach a more general public. But in both cases, what we see is, I would say, a sort of tension between two things. I try to illustrate this using the difference between dado. Dado is a traditional. He's the same age of me, in his late 30s, and he started painting graffiti when he was 13. And he started with bombing and tag writing, and then he moved on, and he moved to this very sophisticated three-dimensional thing. But Dado increasingly stopped doing illegal pieces, and now you can see that it's all... He does conventional graffiti pieces, but in more public institutional events, or he gets hired by some people to actually do what he himself defines as urban decoration. This is another term that came up yesterday. Decoration. Decoration, very interesting term. Decorum. Decorum in Latin, what is apposite, what is appropriate, what embellish. And decorum is, of course, to make a decorum, you have actually to own the place. You have to be the master of that place, and decorum is only necessarily legal. It's only necessarily official. This is the idea of decoration. And illustration is another term that came up yesterday. Illustration on walls. Illustration on walls. So here you are very much, in a way, inside, in a sense. You are taken very much inside the game. So playing the game. Bross is another generation. It's kind of 10 years younger, and he was he started as a conventional graffiti writer, but then he moved on, as you can see, to street art. And this is very recent. He just painted it. I interviewed him last time, for the second time, a couple of months ago, and he was going to do. He was just working on this thing here, and Padiglione Natura in Milan. He's from Milan. He underwent a trial, and very interestingly, for his graffiti, it was caught while he was painting, and very interestingly, a prominent art critic in Italy, Vittorio Sgarbi, very much associated with the right wing administration, said, "No, we can't arrest Bross, because it would be like arresting Giotto." So he compared Bross to Giotto, and he said, "This is the tradition of Italian art history. He is the offspring of this tradition, and we should cherish him." And Sgarbi, politically speaking, is a very conservative man. It's very interesting to see this thing. So there must be something like that. The difference between Dado and Bross is that Dado came of age where he's technically speaking, he was ready. He says he was ready to do more challenging things already in the mid 90s, when the graffiti scene was very much underground thing. And no museum, no art gallery, and no art exhibition would include graffiti. except that a few avant-garde things like Ali Novi in the 80s, when Basquiat and the first graffiti art exhibitions were set up in Bologna. That is very interesting because Dado is based in Bologna. So Bologna has got this kind of tradition of a city where, you know, there is this margins in between, you know, the underground and more established cultural practices. But when he was, I mean, he was ready to become, let's say, an integrated cultural producer, he had no opportunities to do that from a strictly economical point of view. He couldn't make his living out of graffiti, as he paradoxically Bross had the opportunity to do since the beginning, in a way. And paradoxically, his trial was the moment when he went big, because precisely while he was being arrested, he had been invited to the PAC, Padiglione d'Arte Contemporanea, by Sgarbi himself, to a major graffiti exhibition. So you see this 10-year span changed things dramatically in terms of, so what are we doing? And the limit is, and I stop here, I would say, with this this final tension, I would say, playing the game and changing the game. Playing the game, being inside the system, doing more of the same, doing urban decoration. Changing the game, actually, I would say, what street artists did at the beginning, Brandalism began this with this movement, this attitude at changing the game, reclaiming defacement as a valorization practice, and drawing from a much longer tradition in which we might include the Situationist International practice of Détourment and the fluxus art notion of presence of the artist being there, setting actually new scales and measures. Playing the game and changing in the game do not at all correspond with graffiti and street art. Of course, the problem is that street art is today caught in this more of the same thing, and we saw it very, very much yesterday. So it's a very complex circuit that I think we should try to reconstruct and analyze and see this moving border, this moving boundary between these two dimensions of value creation and value enhancement. It is as if we can't produce value out of single objects, but we need this public domain, we need this circulation, we need this milieu to produce value. But at the same time, there is this tendency to cache value into objects. And of course, when you want to cache value, you have to go back to these single pieces and so these are all the paradoxes that are created also for preservationist purposes. Save or protect the value of a certain cultural enterprise, but we only save an object. What of the rest of the scene of the cultural milieu that made possible, that actually created the value of that? Of that object, and what happens when this verwertung thing game is applied to places? So we also see that places themselves have these careers and that they change their values, and then we can move from a stigmatized area into a sort of hip neighborhood and all sorts of spatial transformation, including the ruin. The aesthetics of ruined game that we saw yesterday. The Situationists were already very aware that for each detourment, for each breaching of the system, for each attempt at changing the game, there is what they called a recuperation. There is a recuperation and integration by the system. It happened with punk, it happened with all sorts of avant-garde movements. It happened with the Situationists themselves, which are now collected as, you know, there's a cult of the Situationist International, and you can buy all sort of relics and the boards manuscripts and stuff at exorbitant prices. So again, you want to extract the object. And so, you know, it's a complex game, and I think we need to pay attention to this. So I thank you very much for your attention. Sorry for being so long. Okay. Thanks.
So we started a bit later, so we are 10 minutes late, and we have around 20 minutes for discussion, for comments, ideas, inspiration. So please, who is ready just to start asking, commenting?
There is a lot of reflection among us on the terms and concepts that we use. I enjoyed very much. And so to continue this tendency or tradition, I would like to ask you about the expression ecological competition that you used. Mm-hmm. I mean, in Chicago School understanding, in their attempt to use biological metaphor to describe how the composition of certain areas is changing, it's kind of understandable. Those who are stronger come instead of those who couldn't make it. But when you use the term competition to say that there is ecological competition between graffiti and advertisement, I'm intrigued, because lately competition is a kind of, it's already heavily ideologically aggressively appropriated by neoliberal ideology. So the competition is, first of all, something that has been imposed on all of us when it comes to universities, when it comes to scholars, when it comes to cities, and so forth. So who is speaking about competition if you say there is an ecological competition between advertisement and graffiti? Mm-hmm. Is it the result of your observation? Are you sure that it's exactly what is going on? Or you just inadvertently borrowed this metaphor from predominant discourse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you know, the point is that I'd like to use ecology as part of this, but of course it's not the whole story, because ecology tends to naturalize the process and to evict agency from these processes. You look at it from, let's say, a top-down, right, as if it were a natural history kind of process. And so through the human ecology, Chicago School had this way of describing the way in which populations were competing for scarce resources and stuff. To be true, they also had this second stage, which they themselves called conflict, which is not simply competition, but it's something more articulate, which creates interaction and stuff, of course. But yeah, competition in the sense that, when you have a piece of graffiti over metro signage, for instance, like, you cover it, so you can't use the let's say the second layer in a sense of information. Then there are all sort of parasitical relationships which become more interesting. Like, for instance, of course, brandalism is installing inside the enemy's field and making the machine of the enemy break down or fail or contradict itself by the very working of its visibility. It's parasitism, which is another ecological relationship. There is also the reverse type of parasitism, where, and this is where I can refer directly to my observations, conventional graffiti writers, where they said, it's part of the game if they buff my stuff. If they, you know, if they, of course, I work in illegality, and it's good if this thing is gone. Not only this, but they clear me the canvas for the next time I go. So, you know, it's they help me if they efface my, if they remove my piece. But what I can't really stand, what it really makes me angry and wants me to smash everything, is when I see an advertisement like a new SUV model, and in the background of the city there is a graffiti, you know, like to connote that it's a cool, urban, gritty urban place. And in the front you got this big, huge, expensive car. So they themselves have been parasitized. So I think ecology does not exhaust our work, but it's interesting insofar as it enables us to see some of these curious relationship. And then, of course, there are not only layerings, there is not only, like, you know, but there are all sort of transparencies. I was referring to this because one of the tendencies I haven't shown this. One of the tendencies of, you know, graffiti wars, especially in the U.S., there has been this tough attitude against graffiti since the beginning. So graffiti has been always prosecuted as a grave crime, as a major crime, as a major offense. And this has created, you know, this sort of tendency for even more radical stuff. And so the more radical the repression becomes, and here, of course, we can see that you can describe it. We don't describe everything, but it's, of course, an ecological process. The more resistant it becomes, and the end point is acid tags, tags made with acids, which you can't remove, you can't delete, because they actually scrape the surface. Actually, the name graffiti comes from graffiare, not scraping, and actually in scrape, it's not painting, it's scraping. And this is, you know, like the very radical thing. And yesterday with Luke we were sort of talking about this materials issue. Yeah. This is a very, you know, acid tags is really, you know, the way back in a sense.
Same with scratching the glass.
Yeah.
Yes.
As soon as they stop the paint on the outside of the train, go inside the train and you scratch the glass, it becomes more impressive. Yeah. You take it out of the train yards, it goes onto the rooftops.
Yes. And that's ecology. You move the niche. No, you want to. You know, it's.
I mean, just to sort of jump in there, I was really glad to kind of stress those differences. We were sort of talking yesterday about the kind of, is it worth discerning? Is there a sort of, is that differentiation worth making between graffiti, lights, and street art? And I do absolutely agree. I think you made that point really strongly, particularly around the sort of points around precarity and risk. Mm-hmm. They're completely different. In my experience, but also I think I just wanted to add this sort of concept of kind of legibility to the sense of visibility. That the point with sort of graffiti writing in the 70s was that it wasn't legible to a mass public. It didn't want to speak to a mass public. What it wanted to do is be visible and illegible, and that's why you'd paint a train in very desperate conditions in the Bronx, and the train would go into the city centre to a mass public, and they were scared because they didn't understand it and they couldn't read it. They could see it. They couldn't read it. This sort of sense of legibility and visibility, I think, speaks to that sense of public. Well, just my experience in London, in terms of the atmosphere, there's some stencils going around at the moment that just say, oh wow, look, another piece of street art. And there's stencils. It's this sort of very knowing, oh, isn't it? You know, so cool, you know. There are street art tours in London, and they're advertised with stencils. We have an estate agent firm called Foxtons, who are the kind of emblems of kind of gentrification. If you get a Foxtons estate agent turn up in the neighbourhood, you know your house price is very nice, and they are kind of branded with graffiti branding. This is the kind of reverse of the car that they literally have Foxtons estate agent cars with street art on them. Whereas graffiti writing is it's a very threatening culture, still very prevalent, but it's much less tolerant.
It's also, it's much less governable in a way, especially bombing. And but the when I talk to traditional graffiti writers, what they were keen on emphasizing is that their object is completely different, because their object is writing, they write writing, actually. The point is not illustration, it's the specific object is letter, in the sense that lettering is the next stage, but it's really the act of writing that is the specific object of graffiti writing. And you write writings, which then can be letters, but it can also be ideograms. You can make ideogrammatic graffitis and whatever, but the writing is the thing. So it's much stricter in a way. And the figures are called puppets because they are, you know, like put around. Yeah, they are decorations actually inside the graffiti logics. Yes, work, yes, embellishment.
Yeah.
That's the real subject. The real subject is the writing. So it's, and that's the reason why some graffiti writers say we are much more dogmatic than street artists, because it's a dogma. You have to have the letter at the center. Letter, it's even a second degree thing, but the fact of the writing, which then can be, which then can form letters and stuff, but. Marxian, not Marxist. means belonging to Marx. Yeah.
Somehow mixed it up with idea of cultural value, and but it's probably it's not the same thing. I mean, the price. What are we talking about? The price.
Yeah.
The cultural value. For example, and probably this. If we talk about cultural value, we can. Talk only about one public because we necessarily should talk about different communities, different I don't know, people with different cultures or something like that. And so it means that probably sometimes this price is not the same with cultural value, and sometimes these mechanisms of extracting the object will work. With price, for example, it would be okay to extract some object, and the value, the price of this object will be even higher than if it still remains in the same environment. For example, some piece of art, some piece of Banksy, between a museum or between a private gallery or so on, it doesn't lose its price, but for some people, for some communities, for some kind of public, it loses its cultural value.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's different notions, and probably it's effective for your research to compare these different.
I don't know. For some reasons, I can't buy this difference, because what I really aim at is to show that value is this polymorphous thing, that it flows through the economy. Of course, everything that has value, ultimately, I mean, it has economic impacts. But the origin of value is not economic, in a sense. I mean, it's what I'm interested in is, you know, we could even say that the moment in which we ask ourselves, sitting in a face to face, I mean, what is value and what has value? We are entering the political domain in a way, because we are. I mean, it's ultimately the moment in which we make some sort of agreement between ourselves on value. Is so. I don't know. What would be the distinction between economic and cultural value, unless it's something related? Because actually, what I wanted to show is that value is inherently linked to some circuits of circulation. So the question then becomes, who are involved? Who is involved? Who are the actors involved in this circulation? And how do they handle this thing that they do in common? And the notion of milieu, environment, atmosphere, whatever, social field, if you want, is this idea that it is in these geometers of connection that values have something to do with these connections. So
probably it's, maybe it's not a problem of theory of concept, but it's, I think it's still a problem of methodology, and it's not only methodologies, but precisely method, because how will we measure value?
Yes, that's the problem.
It will depend on what kind of value we are looking for. I mean, if for us it's just enough to measure the price, it's one case, or if we trying to deal with what they call it cultural value, or somehow the next step, somehow compare it, measure and compare it with price and so on. But it's very important methodology.
I have no answers really, because I'm really puzzling about this notion. I think it's one of the most perplexing and complex notion ever. But what would be an example of a cultural value to you? I mean, because I can't see.
Compared to cases, for example, if the block of East Side Gallery was put in some private gallery, the price of this block is still very high, but for a community who tried to protect it and who lost it, probably this kind of deconstructization, when the object was extracted from that particular place, for them it would mean that it already lost its kind of authenticity and its cultural value at the end. So here we have kind of contradiction, because for the person who bought it, it's still very valuable, but for other people who tried to protect and try to do everything to lose this piece of wall at that place, at that authentic place, it's completely different.
Yes, but that's the point Sharon Zukin makes when she studies these dynamics in places like Harlem and stuff. She says, why these places acquire their value? Because they have this resonance of authenticity to them. And so people do look for these authentic places and want to go to live there. And this is that, you know, the same thing. It's value that circulates and takes on various shapes. And the paradox is that whenever you extract something from an environment, you have the feeling of grasping its value, but in fact you are destroying it basically.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Just please. So
you are destroying, and you're not destroying it as a number.
You're not destroying the whole other. I mean.
Yeah. Okay, so probably we'll continue this discussion in the break, but we still have some questions, and probably we have like 5 minutes to add them, to put it brief, and then to answer that. So Natalia, and then Piotr,
yeah.
And maybe Elena, if
yeah, I can
time left.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Okay, Andrea, thank you so much for this broad theoretical grounded picture you provide. So, we don't have time for many examples, but what we feel after this, after listening to your presentation, is providing a lot of different examples of values and everything from different contexts. But I want to provide just one, and I want to ask you, have you ever been to street art tours?
To a street art tour? No, not yet.
I got it because
Yes.
They showed. But actually, Oksana and I were in Berlin and we took one. It is completely different thing that you have to imagine. So it is not this hip thing or something for upper class. No, it was absolutely environmentally conscious. So the girl who took us to while to Berlin, she was she was speaking actually the same language as we did. And she didn't show objects, but she showed us environments and places which are transformed by people who reclaim the city.
There's a misunderstanding. I don't claim that all street art tours are like this, but I show that it can be also, they can also turn into this, of course.
My point wasn't that you were wrong and I saw it and I went, no. No, it was about, I was talking about yesterday, about the changing of archives, and here we see the changing of tours in a way. So this kind of activities as street art and graffiti change this more traditional ways to make city tour, for example. Because I think they demand different attitude to that. And of course sometimes maybe it doesn't work, but sometimes we saw an example where it worked pretty well. So it was just an example, and I still want to ask you about one methodological question. It is about norms, because it would be more convenient for me to speak about norms which values manifest itself when we talk about public space and conflicts in public space. And you haven't even mentioned norms.
Yeah.
So what is the, I don't know why, and your principal choice was for values, and how do you resolve this problem, which is quite, I think it's a traditional sociological values and norms.
Yes. No, I know, but I wanted to stress the notion of value in the singular rather than in the plural. I mean, it's and norms. Of course, it has to do with the fact that public space and it's always a governed space. So, you know, it's inscribed in an exercise of administration actually, and so there are attempts at, you know, creating a set of norms and attitudes for this. There is an attempt at disciplination, if you want. But then public domain, it can never be governed, in a sense. It resists this attempt at being governed. So, you know, the norm is a very Foucauldian thing. You are normal, we are normated, because, you know how to behave yourself, you know, the limits of, you know, it's self-disciplining, basically. But at the same time, you want to escape these norms because, you know, they are like straitjackets and so you... But the value, I wanted what I aim at is to think that there is something in the singular that takes on all these different faces, that moves across. It's a very polymorphous... think it's a very polymorphous notion. So it's not values in the sense like social values, friendship and respect. It's value in a very, you know, like what is the production of this intensive moment of social life that we think we can localize. The problem is really with localization. You think you can localize it, but it's moving, and when you try to grasp it, as I was saying, it's not that you are destroying the value. Maybe maybe you can cash it, but you are, in a sense, you know, destroying the origin, what made it possible, in a sense. You're sort of, it's just like cutting a plant, and you can still see the flower on the top, but it's a dying flower because you have cut it from where it grows from, you know.
Yeah. Please, please.
It's not a question, I think. It's more like a comment and more like a development of the discussion with a warrior. I think that there is a kind of delusive thing that you are speaking about land value.
Sorry?
When you are speaking about a land value.
Land value. Land value, okay, land value, yeah.
Because I think that in the case of street art, graffiti, it's more like speaking about quality of environment value, which is which are rather different from the neoliberal understanding of land value and land market. So it brings new markets and new service for consumers to the land that are unseen when we think about a land market. So it gives new qualities of the environment which can attract some kind of people, distract the others, it produces our own auditory, etc. So I think that the the difference between the cultural value and economical value is a wrong difference that appears when we speak about street art and graffiti in terms of land. But when we speak in terms of environmental quality, then that disappears because it becomes a part of constructing the environmental quality value.
Environmental quality, what would be an example of to understand what you mean?
Environmental quality, I don't know. When we speak about the urban environment, urban environment has a different quality that attract or distract some groups of people. For example, here in Russian in Moscow center, we have very attractive environmental quality for pedestrians in the center, but it's completely unacceptable for some disabled people, and so that's environmental quality works as a form of definition between diversification between
distinction
of different groups of the consumers of this environment. So the graffiti works just the same. It attracts some groups and distracts the others. So, so it brings to the logic of land value and land market the new dimensions, and apparently it's a whole new market rather than the land market, I think.
Yes, but what I'm interested in is in the feedback. I mean, in the fact that this changes of transformation in environmental quality, as you call it, ultimately are of interest also to real estate agents. That's a curious thing that I can't help but noticing. I mean, it's in the sense that they are also, as everybody else, interested in the in this kind of game.
Okay. Thank you, everyone, for your questions. Thank you for your presentation. And we'll have 10 minutes break and then continue our discussion.
Sorry, thanks. I spoiled the break. I'm sorry.